From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we welcome back Canadian filmmaker Guy Madden to talk about his new surreal comedy, which is steeped in tragedy, The Saddest Music in the World. It's set during the Depression in Madden's hometown, Winnipeg, one of the coldest places in North America. It stars Isabella Rossellini as a beer baroness who sponsors a contest to find the saddest music in the world. The film is inspired by silent movies and Depression-era musicals. Madden's other films include Tales from the Gimli Hospital and Dracula, Tales from a Virgin's Diary. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers choreographer George Balanchine and his relationship to music. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Balanchine's birth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military says two American soldiers were killed and five wounded today when a building in Baghdad exploded as they were searching it for chemical weapons. NPR's Philip Reeves says some Iraqis appeared jubilant as they looted the soldiers' Humvees after the blast.
Opposition to the occupation in Baghdad has been running fairly high. There have been pockets where it is stronger, and the evidence of today's explosion, judging by the reaction to it at ground level, is that it is quite strong in the area where this occurred, as Iraqis swarmed around the Humvees and with spanners and other instruments began taking it apart and seemed to be in a triumphant mood as they were doing this.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the U.S. is offering $100,000 to the Red Cross to aid victims of last week's devastating train explosion in North Korea. The blast reportedly killed more than 160 people and injured more than 1,300. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Powell says the U.S. is working through international aid groups to help North Korea. He made clear this gesture is not about strengthening the U.S. negotiating position when it comes to North Korea.
This offer stands on its own merits. This is a humanitarian catastrophe that has befallen the people of North Korea, and the United States is offering it in that spirit and in that spirit alone.
The United States has no formal relations with North Korea and has been working with countries in the region to pressure Pyongyang to halt its nuclear weapons program. Even so, Washington remains a major food supplier to the impoverished nation and is now responding to North Korea's rare appeal for international help to cope with those injured in last week's train disaster. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry campaigned today in West Virginia, saying that President Bush has not delivered on new jobs and has failed to protect American workers.
Our trade agreements ought to be enforced, and they ought to be enforced tough in order to give the workers of America faith that the government's actually on their side.
Meanwhile, the Bush administration criticized Kerry's record on national security. Speaking today in Missouri, Vice President Dick Cheney attacked Kerry's judgment on defense issues and said that Kerry voted against key weapons systems in the Senate.
From the beginning of his career in the U.S. Senate 20 years ago, Senator Kerry has repeatedly called for major reductions or outright cancellations of many of our most important weapon systems.
Democrats retorted that Cheney had tried to kill important weapon systems when he was defense secretary in the first Bush administration. In stocks, the Dow lost 28 points to close at 10,444. The Nasdaq was down 13 to 2036. This is NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court will not hear arguments to reinstate mealtime prayers at a state-supported military school. Dutchie Morelli reports from member station WVTF.
The court turned aside an appeal from state officials who wanted to keep the tradition of suppertime prayers at Virginia Military Institute. The action means that a lower federal court ruling calling the prayer unconstitutional will stand. In his dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that leaving church-state questions unresolved is unfair to VMI. But another justice said the case had procedural problems. The case was born after two cadets complained they were not allowed to ignore the chaplain-led prayers. Virginia officials said cadets weren't forced to participate, but an appeals court disagreed, calling the tradition an official act. The mealtime prayers at VMI stopped after that ruling. For NPR News, I'm Dutchie Morelli in Roanoke, Virginia.
The Bush administration says it will give the Red Cross $10,000 to help victims of last week's train collision in North Korea. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the U.S. will also provide medical supplies and emergency medical specialists if they're needed. McClellan said the aid is being provided to North Korea despite U.S. political differences with the Asian nation. Emergency officials in North Korea say about 160 people were killed and more than 1,300 were injured in last Thursday's crash. The State Department said the U.S. is one of the largest suppliers of aid to North Korea and donated about 100,000 tons of food to the isolated communist nation last year. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 5 points to close at nearly 1,135. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Guy Maddin, has been called the best filmmaker you've never heard of. In the Boston Globe, Wesley Morris said, quote, "He's a scholar, poet, and prankster, and ferociously devoted classicist who likes to resurrect dead cinemas and deader directors and make them vital all over again," unquote. Maddin's movies include Tales from the Gimli Hospital and Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary. It's a film adaptation of a ballet version of the Dracula story. Visually, Maddin's work is inspired by silent films and German Expressionism. His new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, also pays homage to Depression-era musicals. It's a surrealistic comedy set during the Depression in Winnipeg, one of the coldest places in North America, which also happens to be the place where Guy Maddin grew up and still makes his home. The Saddest Music in the World stars Isabella Rossellini as the owner of a beer brewery who, as part of a promotional scheme, launches an international contest to find the saddest music in the world.
We at Musket Beer are proud that Winnipeg has been chosen 4 years in a row by the London Times as the world capital of sorrow in the Great Depression. In recognition of this honor, we will be hosting a worldwide contest to determine which nation's music truly deserves to be called the saddest in the world. Aspiring virtuosos of tearful melody are welcome to travel here and lay claim to the jewel-studded crown of frozen tears and $25,000 in prize money. That's right.
Guy Maddin, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your movie, The Saddest Music in the World, is adapted from a screenplay that was written by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day.
Right.
But his screenplay was set in the 80s, and yours is set in the 1930s during the Depression. I think you probably reworked a lot of the original concept. Talk about your idea for what the contest would be like to find the saddest music in the world.
Well, the original premise of such a contest was Ish's, and he saw it as a political satire, mostly about the way it's kind of sad that countries that are already suffering from the worst privations imaginable still have to pretend to be even worse off than they really are, just to get some sort of international sympathy and charity, and that everyone is forced into this undignified limbo contest of exaggerating their misery to get some charity. And for me, the contest was a great backdrop for the way families and people in love manipulate each other in much the same way that countries do. And it was a great great chance for me to have an orgy of self-pity, not just among nations, but among family members. You know, the way families really mess with each other's minds. And so I just found sort of a microcosm within Ish's political satire. And my obsessions are always with family melodrama anyway. So it was just a matter of putting that peanut butter on Ish's chocolate and coming up with something that pleased us both.
Before we talk about the actual stories that set all the characters grieving, let's talk about the music a little bit. There actually is a contest in the movie for the saddest music in the world, and representatives from countries around the world show up to perform their music and vie for the cash reward.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about finding performers from around the world to use in this contest? Because you have real performers from different countries.
Yeah. Most of them live in my hometown of Winnipeg.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I imagined you going around the world.
That's right. That's right. On a big talent
putting
search.
Classifieds in newspapers around the world.
That's right. Going to Moscow and
exactly.
Stockholm.
Scotland.
No, we just put an ad in the paper and actually dealt through the Winnipeg Folk Arts Council and just arranged for a massive audition. We just told various El Salvadorian musicians, Portuguese fado musicians, Ukrainian bandurists to show up in costume with their instruments in full plumage and to play the two saddest songs they had in their repertoire. And we just invited them all to come up to this very tiny, crowded ballroom we rented in a hotel. They all had to ride up in an elevator, a very tiny elevator, so a big mariachi band would crowd out of the elevator while the Heather Bells, the all-female Highland bagpipe troupe, marched in. And it was great just to see the clash of colors, plaids, sombreros. It was really exciting, and I realized I kind of had half my musical problems solved right there at the audition. It was just a matter of picking my favorites from this and just getting a nice balance of colors and costumes and musics.
How did you explain yourself to them?
I kind of didn't, and that was kind of fun, just looking at the sheer puzzlement on their faces. And at one point in the auditions, I always encouraged the last group of musicians to stay on while the next one came on, and I would have them play at the same time and actually have them try to cross-pollinate or actually get down lower. I was thinking in terms of limbo, and I would tell the klezmer clarinetist to get down below the Ukrainian clarinetist and try to get down lower, lower in pitch and lower in physicality and literally compete and cross swords with clarinets. And it was really kind of fun to watch these people literally competing for the tears of of the judges, me, my producers, musically, and it was all just sort of playing itself out the way it did in the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like a battle of the bands, except that they're all playing incredibly sad music.
Yeah, and it really was just like, just watching this self-pitying ants at a tea party just going at it and trying to top each other's stories of woe. I grew up in a family where people did that all the time, where Icelandic and all stories about our family are about tragedy and misery and plagues, blight, volcanic eruptions, etc.
Let me play the song I'd probably vote for if I were a judge in this contest for the saddest music in the world. And I'll just play an excerpt of this. This is a Mexican song, sung from the point of view of a mother who is singing to her dead baby. And as we hear the song, we'll also hear the announcers who are announcing this contest as it happens. And, of course, they're totally undercutting the tragedy with their absolutely clueless explanations of what's going on. So why don't we hear the scene?
Are giving us a sad peek into child burial customs down Mexico way.
The Mexican mama is being very firm with her dead infant. Now go away, she wails.
You are dead. Don't sneak in at night to nurse from my breast. That milk is only for the living.
To Canadian ears, that may sound harsh.
Well, I guess dead children, like any other kind, have got to learn.
That's a short scene from Guy Maddin's new film, The Saddest Music in the World. Guy, tell me.
I actually have a song, songwriting credit on that song, by the way.
Oh, did you co-write it?
I cannot read music, but I wrote the lyrics. I can't speak Spanish either, but I had the singer translated, and I just had to trust the translation.
What went through your mind as you were writing this?
Well, I just...
I mean, how did you come up with this idea of the woman singing to her dead child?
Well, there's nothing sadder than that, but you know, in spite of the recent epidemic of dead child movies that have been put out there, I find it extremely difficult to even approach the magnitude, the enormity of such a feeling. So it had, the only way to present it for me was to undercut it instantly somehow, and just to let off the clear message that I wasn't going to try to reach anybody's heart at that point. It was just had to be goofy.
Guy, would you tell the story of what sets this in motion? Why everybody is so filled with grief in this movie? It's such a complicated story. I'm hoping you can do it justice in some short summary.
Well, I remember when my collaborator and I were starting to write about it, George Tolles. He and I developed this thesis that Europeans and Americans grieved musically differently. That Europeans embraced their sadnesses more directly through their music, and the music spoke directly of their sadness, perhaps because Europe has been the arena of two great world wars, or perhaps it's a temperament that just goes back many more centuries. And that Americans have always gleefully repressed their sadnesses through their music. When you think of the Great Depression, you think of all the great Tin Pan Alley tunes like We're in the Money and I Want to Be Happy, and you know, just these kind of things that go against. There were only a few hit songs, Brother Can You Spare a Dime, that kind of directly addressed the misery that America was feeling at that time. And so I thought it would be fun to have an American character who was just typical of this repression and kind of from one of those Busby Berkeley movies, some sort of Broadway impresario that just is irrepressible, never acknowledges for a second that he's sad, and feels that he can win a sad music contest the same way he'd win a happy music contest, just by mounting bigger and bigger production numbers and just making sadness so spectacular to look at that it would be fun. Meanwhile, his brother, because it's sort of set up in fairy tale structural terms, his brother is a man who's gone back to live in Europe and has embraced his Serbian roots and
because Serbia is such a sad country.
Yeah, it is, and I always wanted to get Gavrilo Princip into the man who, in reductive terms, started World War I by shooting the Archduke and his wife. So I just thought I could compress all this sadness into a single bullet and into one person that represented the sadness of all Europe, and that would be fun. So he was really drinking highly concentrated lugubriousness at all times, and that these brothers would share a woman, because love triangles are the three-cylinder engines that propel some of the greatest, you know, screwball comedies and melodramas of all time. And there we sort of had it. It was this thesis of the two different approaches to sad music and then just a simple love triangle that sets the movie up.
My guest is filmmaker Guy Maddin. His new movie is called The Saddest Music in the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Guy Maddin. His new movie is called The Saddest Music in the World. It's a surreal, melodramatic comedy set during the Depression in frozen Winnipeg, Maddin's hometown. It stars Isabella Rossellini as a beer mogul who launches a contest to find the saddest music in the world. Well, thinking back to the last interview that you did on Fresh Air after your ballet version of Dracula, and somehow we were talking about grief, which of course relates to this new movie, and you had mentioned that that your brother killed himself when he was 19, that he shot himself on the grave of his girlfriend.
Yeah, when I was 7, or just turning 7, I remember thinking, it was quite thoughtless of him to do that just a week before my birthday. Yeah, it was, you know, obviously a horrible tragedy. It's the worst thing that could happen to parents. I was young enough that it was turned into a romance for me. The idea that he got to go to heaven with his girlfriend and that they were somehow being virtually married there, and that that our two families, the family of the dead girlfriend and my family, sort of considered each other in-laws as a way of making sense of this gesture of their sadnesses. It just seemed very romantic to me, the idea of, you know, very Wuthering Heights, you know, the idea of just giving your whole life for the love of somebody. And maybe that's what made me more receptive to romantic literature later, and I don't know, but it seems like the little garden from which I sprung was well watered with tears. It didn't. This isn't self-pity talking. It's something I just observed as a way of growing up. It didn't. Like I said, I couldn't have had a happier childhood. I loved it.
How did your brother's girlfriend die?
In a car accident. It was you know, it was horrible. But and it just ruined him. You know, it was. He hung in there for about 6 months and then couldn't take it anymore.
There's a car accident in this movie too.
Yeah, there is, although the words car accident don't mean anything to me. They probably are horrible words to hear for the girl's family, but I don't know. All the trappings of that incident were kind of just, they were just as artificial as a TV show to me at that age, so I don't cringe or tweak when I hear those words.
It didn't scare you to death that your brother in one gesture was able to take his life away?
Well, I, you know, I don't know how to make sense of what I thought of it. I know I was given his bedroom the very night that he did it, and he had a way better bedroom than I did, and so I was, you know, I was pretty happy about that. I shared it with my other brother, who couldn't stand the sound of my night breathing. You know, it sort of haunted him a lot, and it might have. And I immediately thought I was him, and, you know, immediately started thinking about what it would be like to die or to kill myself. And, you know, in those ways that every child daydreams about, just wanting to go away when things don't go right, to remove yourself. But, you know, I never really seriously considered it. It was just kind of a play daydream that I like to replay all the time.
I'm thinking back to something else you said in that first interview that we did. You said that when people who were important to you died, you felt you didn't grieve at the time, and that you even had to fake tears at their funeral. And I was thinking, you know, this just seems so connected to me, to this new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, because, you know, one of the characters just is incapable of grieving, and he kind of walks through life as if it were like a bleak comedy. And another character goes through life, because her grief is so deep, she falls into amnesia. Her only way of surviving is just totally to forget.
I guess you're very astute, Terry, because I think you have picked up on some kind of autobiographical trait that I've put in the movie, maybe without even thinking about it. I know when I was in my mid-teens, my father developed a very serious heart condition, and I just lived in terror of him just dropping dead of a heart attack. And the words heart attack literally launched me, whenever I happened to hear them on TV or in a conversation, would launch me into a procedure of elaborate superstitions, you know, crossing my fingers, knocking on wood, backing out of a room, left foot first, and all sorts of elaborate, strange, exhausting procedures. And I think when my father finally did have a heart attack and die, that or when he did die of some heart-related thing, that a fuse went in me, and I couldn't grieve. It was everything I'd feared and worse, because it really happened, and I just felt nothing, and I felt a bit ashamed of myself for not feeling anything, but I'm sure it's common that some people just can't feel anything. I guess it's just simply being in shock. Well, it didn't even feel like being in shock. I remember actually kind of enjoying all the company and sympathy I was getting around funeral time. It's pretty gloomy stuff we're talking about, but then I did grieve in the installment plan. I for years I was revisited by my father in regular dreams, just probably a pathological number of dreams. And so these characters, this woman who virtually is visited with amnesia when her child dies is kind of just a version of that, I guess. It's just a matter of her being faced with something that's just unbearable, and amnesia is the only way to go. Amnesia and nymphomania, as it turns out.
That's right. She's got that, too.
That's two Band-Aids on top of a trauma.
Let me quote two things about sadness that are said in the movie. One is, what good is memory? Why make yourself sad? And the other is, sadness is just happiness turned on its ass. It's all showbiz.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sense of what sadness is. I know I don't like being sad very much, and the weirdest things make me sad. I don't know.
Like what?
Sometimes a movie that's mediocre for some reason. I like a really bad movie or a really good movie, but a movie that just somehow, there's a certain combination of notes that mediocrity combines to form and that just about has me suicidal. For some reason, the second Matrix movie had me on suicide alert. I had to make some hotline phone calls after walking out of that theater. I don't know.
Why? Because mediocrity wastes your time, or because there's something emotional in a mediocre film? Like, what is it?
Yeah, that one, I started daydreaming a bit about my brother, something I almost never do. And I know he was a bit of a science fiction enthusiast and kind of a technical freak. He built a stereo with his bare hands when he was 15 years old, and built a radio station and was arrested for broadcasting, from a pirate station when he was a young teen. And so I just started thinking of, I started daydreaming that I was watching this movie with him for some reason. This is something I've never done before. And then the movie was so overwhelmingly filled with effects that he would never have been able to comprehend at his young age. And then, but then it was so incomprehensibly boring at the same time that I remember just sort of thinking that maybe my brother would decide that he should have lived all along just because these movies are so cool and so technically slick, and that the excitement of science would have made it worthwhile to keep on living. And then I realized I was losing him as the movie got worse and worse, and that by the end of the movie he was back in his grave and I was looking for one for myself. I don't know.
Oh, gosh. This is what happens when your mind wanders when a movie's really dull.
Yeah, I probably should have just gone to see, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle again.
Was that better?
That was way better. I love that movie.
We'll talk more with Guy Maddin about his new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, smoothies, and cultured soy. 10% of profits are donated to support environmental causes and family farms. Details at stonyfield.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with filmmaker Guy Maddin about his movie The Saddest Music in the World. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers the relationship of choreographer George Balanchine to music. This year marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with filmmaker Guy Maddin. His movies include Tales from the Gimli Hospital and Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary. His new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, is inspired by silent films and Depression-era musicals. It stars Isabella Rossellini as a beer mogul in Winnipeg. As part of a promotional campaign, she launches a contest to find the saddest music in the world. This surrealistic comedy is driven by tragedy, death, disfigurement, and thwarted love. I know you're interested in triangles, and they are the motors that run a lot of drama. But in your movies, the triangle is often within a family. Two men in one family fall in love with the same woman. And I'm wondering why in your storylines it's often two men from the same family falling in love with the same woman.
Yeah, I don't know. It is, though, because it's certainly never been the case in my family. I'll go on record as saying, you know, I don't have a competitive relationship with my other brother or my sister.
Or your father.
With my father, yeah. No. Although in one of my films, I have my father stealing away my beloved sort of thing. I read that one in Turgenev's Spring Torrents, or First Love, that's what it was. I just like the idea of a father just stealing a girl away from his son, just being a Zeus-like, sexually empowered force that can't be beaten. I don't know, there's just something kind of comfy in writing these kind of emasculated roles a little bit. There's just so much great tradition, comedic tradition in emasculation. You know, Buster Keaton would always do these, you know, would always fall prey to these emasculating humiliations. And then, but then his virility would triumph in the end because he's sexy and cute. But so a triangle, you know, always someone wins at the expense of someone else. So you get, I'm never interested in the winner. You know, it's the loser's always more interesting.
In one of your short films, well, it's not really too short. It's about 64 minutes. It's called Cowards Bend the Knee. And it's not really an autobiographical film, although some of it appears to be autobiographical, but one of the characters' names is Guy Maddin, and
yeah.
The father's name is Maddin Sr. And there's it's a silent film, but there's a title card that says, like the French Foreign Legion, the museum is a sanctuary, in this case for cowards, for husbands afraid to face the burdens, nay, the terrors of living with wives and families. I think that's a really interesting... An interesting quote.
That,
I think,
that,
yeah, some people are afraid to face the burdens of living with wives or of living with families. Yeah,
I think so too. And there are a couple of sources for that little quote, that little epitaph. When my father died, I mentioned that he revisited me in dreams, but he was alive, but sort of conditionally alive in these dreams. What he was, quite often he was sick and impatient, and he was coming back just to get a suit or something he'd left hanging in a closet. And then, but this was my chance to convince him to stay with the family. But it sort of seemed obvious that he had a better family that he liked living with, that he was alive but living either down the street or maybe in Minneapolis, you know, the nearest city to Winnipeg, and that he was impatient to get back to this other family, and that he hadn't died, but he had in fact just rejected us. And I've learned that there is a lot of that's a common feeling, that the loved ones left behind by a death feel that there's a feeling of desertion and rejection, rather than just simple straight up bereavement. And and it did sort of feel like in these dreams my father was just too cowardly to face up to our family, or just to tell us that he didn't like us, but he had to just sort of slip away. And I often wonder if that is how he felt. I don't know. And I've found myself being too cowardly to really express my desires and relationships on many occasions. And it was very cathartic to append my name to the biggest coward in this movie and have him behave in all the cowardly ways I've behaved and in the ways I've observed my friends behaving in relationships, and really hyperbolize it until it's unavoidable and that viewers hopefully recognize themselves in that. I've been somewhat less of a coward since making that picture, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The other place, these men that desert their families are all hiding out in a wax museum, and I love The Petrified Man by Eudora Welty, where a man on exhibit in a crummy sideshow is posing as a petrified man, just turns out to be an escaped convict, or it's as if he's running away from something. He's just literally petrified. So I thought I would just extend that into a legion of husbands that are just miserable with their situations but don't know what to do about it.
You said you're less of a coward since having made that movie. Is it the movie that changed you or something else?
No, mostly the movie. I really, you know, it's when you just put all your cowardice right on film and in front of all the crew members and the actors, and you make them do it, and then you show it to some people, and you're the protagonist, someone with your name. I got someone, with a better body and more hair to play me, but he was every bit as cowardly as I've been, and it's kind of an expressionist film, so he's even a little bit more cowardly, or, you know, is the cowardice that I thought he actually expresses, and just finally getting that out, you just see how ugly it is, but how apt and true and timeless, and it's made it easier for me to stick up for myself a bit more.
It's like you're done with the movie, and now it's time to move out onto something else. Like you're done with those things you expressed in the film, and you can move on.
Yeah, but in a way that's disappointing, because I'd really come to love my cowardice in a way. It's really made for some hilarious jackpots that I've gotten into, and now I'm not in as many jackpots, and so I'm sure, don't worry, no one really changes ever, and I'm sure this change is very temporary, and that I'll slide back into the morass of cowardice and all the jackpots it produces.
My guest is filmmaker Guy Maddin. His new movie is called The Saddest Music in the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Guy Maddin. His new movie is called The Saddest Music in the World. It's set during the Depression in Winnipeg, which has been named the world's capital of sorrow. Maddin grew up in Winnipeg and still lives there. He insists he had a very happy childhood there, in spite of the fact it's one of the coldest cities in the world.
There are a few with small populations in northern Siberia that are a little bit colder in the winter, but it's the coldest city of a population of over 100,000 in the world. It's dark. Seasonal adjustment disorder is an epidemic in the wintertime. Its summers are pretty, but there's, you know, tent worm infestations and mosquitoes the size of sparrows and all sorts of things. So the really joyful seasons last about a week, and autumn is nice for the 2 or 3 hours it hangs around before we just sort of fall into winter. And I love winter, though. I love it. It's pretty. It's frosty, and it's nostril-tinglingly freezing, and you get to play all sorts of outdoor sports and lose the feelings in your fingers and toes, and I love it.
There's images of hockey in several of your films, and I know your father was the treasurer and manager of Canada's national hockey team.
Right.
You described yourself in our first interview as spending most of your childhood in front of the television with your dog. Did you play hockey too?
No, I didn't. And believe me, that was a source of unbelievable shame. Growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, father featured frequently in the city's newspaper, talking about Canada's national hockey team and not being able to skate. I don't know. I just spent too much time in front of the TV. Even my dog was stupid and not even paper trained or anything. It was, you know, we were both very underachieving organisms. And I finally couldn't stand the shame anymore. I bought a pair of skates when I was about 18 and just went out after dark and taught myself how to skate. And then just fell in love with it, became obsessed with it, dropped out of university and just spent all my time playing hockey with 12-year-olds. And until I was good enough to join a team. And I still have that kind of learned late skating style. I skate too straight up and down. And people know I was a late comer to the game. But believe me, it's just every stride I take on the ice feels like I'm undoing the shame of my childhood. And I'm not quite done yet. I'm still playing. I'm 48 years old now, and I still play. And I'm not kidding. Every stride I take feels like I'm repairing damage.
Too bad your dog didn't live long enough to undo his reputation.
Yeah, no, my dog lived a pure life, underachieving to the end. It didn't even get out of bed to die. Died on my feet while I was sleeping.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Guy Maddin. His new film is called The Saddest Music in the World. He wrote and directed it. Most of your work is in the silent film style, and even if there's dialogue in it, as there is in The Saddest Music in the World.
Yeah, and lots of it.
And lots of it, and there's music as well. Still, the look, the lighting, the style has a lot to do with silent movies. In The Saddest Music in the World, some of the style also comes from movies of the 30s. And musicals of the 30s. But, you know, your basic film vocabulary seems to come from silent movies. Do you feel like you have to work with a certain type of actor who has a face that could be convincing as a face from 1920s or 30s movies?
Yeah, I'm constantly looking for anachronistically intriguing faces. Just kind of strange, because when you go to a casting agent, it's you know, the headshots you're seeing are just packed with pulchritude, but it's a contemporary beauty that is virtually useless to me, and so I'm always forced to find people that work as, you know, shop girls in chocolate shops and things like that, and they just sort of look like they've come out of a time machine somewhere. In Saddest Music in the World, I'm really lucky with Maria de Medeiros. She does seem to have stepped out of a time machine.
She does. She has those really big eyes that you expect from silent films, and
right.
A kind of pear-faced shape that seems just right.
And, yeah. And she, you know, she played Aeneas Nin in Henry and June, and it was a very convincing anachronism. And
I think I mean heart-shaped face. Pear-shaped face sounds kind of grotesque. I think I mean heart-shaped face.
Yeah, that's right. No. Yeah, no, you're right. It's whatever it is, it's not a form of beauty you see in Vogue magazine or on movie pages very often. So, and then Isabella Rossellini seems kind of timeless, because just the simple act of conversing with her is to experience time travel. It's strange. She'll turn her head 1 second and turn into her mother, Ingrid, and because she speaks a peculiar hybrid Italian Swedish English, I guess English was taught to her by her mother, because her accent is almost identical to Ingrid's, and so sometimes you're in the year 2004 when you're talking to her, and sometimes you feel like you've just stepped off the set of Notorious or something like that. And so there are all sorts of anachronistic powers around her. And so it was easy. She was my first, you know, highly recognizable person to enter my universes and I felt that she was, I was scared to have recognizable people in my universe. I arrogantly thought they were delicate little bubbles that might burst if someone from the present stepped into them. But of all the people to go first, she was the right one.
I want to ask you about another theme that recurs, well, in at least a couple of your films. That is the idea of limbs being amputated, legs or hands. And I won't describe how it comes up in your movie, so people who see it can be surprised or shocked or however they react to it. But why is that a theme for you?
Well, I could back up a little bit. When I came to reading as late as skating, even, and my way into literature, I was very intimidated by it in high school, but my way into it was to treat every story as if it was a fairy tale, and to think of it with the same kind of broad storytelling gestures, conceits and devices that, say, Hans Christian Andersen or the Brothers Grimm used, and they sometimes used very grisly, cruel plot twists. And so when I'm designing my own stories, I'm sort of comfortable thinking of them as fairy tales, and that's why there's frequently brothers that are rivals, because it's just really a fairy tale device for setting up tension and aren't we all brothers and sisters after all and all that stuff. So and also another Another factor would be the fact that I'd just seen a lot of Lon Chaney movies early in my movie viewing career. And he starred in some of the most remarkable films that were, I'm trying to come up with a term that aptly describes him, but they might be allegories of disability, where his tortured soul, his tortured mind, his revenge-addled brain, whatever condition his soul is in, is manifested in some sort of outward disability or injury that must be avenged or dealt with somehow. So this something that makes him different is what drives the story. It's very, you know, from Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Unknown, where he's missing arms or is pretending to be missing arms. They're really intriguing and propelling. And they have nothing to do with literal amputees necessarily. They're just little gentle allegories at first, and then to become savage stories of the human heart that we can all identify with, whether we're amputees or not.
Oh yeah, those are great films. The Unknown is such a great film. If people haven't seen it, I don't know if it's on video or DVD.
It is. It's on DVD. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a really great film. You know, I'd like you to, since you've probably seen a lot of films from the 20s and 30s, and probably a lot of them are fairly obscure, but maybe available now on video or DVD. Can you recommend a few?
Oh, sure. Well, some of them are just from the big silent movie canon.
Mm-hmm.
The Murnau films, The Last Laugh, and Faust, and Sunrise. I really like the Frank Borzage pictures, although those aren't that available. Those are hard to get at. Maybe I'll shame someone who has the rights into putting it out. Seventh Heaven, and any amnesia story. There's a number of film noirs that deal with amnesia that I love. I don't know. The really good film noirs. I love The Chase, which is kind of the 1940s, The Chase. It's really obscure, but that one should be put out on a DVD. It's by Arthur Ripley. It stars Robert Cummings as a guy who's forgotten that he's killed somebody. There's another Cornell Woolrich one, Dark Angel, where Dan Duryea spends the entire movie searching for a killer and only to find out that he had forgotten that he was the killer. You know, that sort of thing. I guess Memento sort of owed a lot to that. But these are tremendous. I just love the delirium produced by the amnesiac characters. Is a legal narcotic I can't get enough of.
Right, and I'll remind our listeners that there's some amnesia in your new movie, The Saddest Music in the World. Now, you live in Winnipeg, one of the coldest cities in the world with one of the longest winters, and when you're there, you're pretty removed from the rest of the world outside of, you know, through radio and television and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you make a movie and you come out and you do some interviews and you maybe go on a tour or something, is it an incredible difference to the rest of your life? I mean,
yeah, at first it was. I'm getting a little better at it. At first it was incredibly disorienting and a bit overwhelming, and I didn't know what to expect. It created feelings that sure felt like disappointment in me, and I wasn't quite able to pinpoint why I was disappointed because things were going swimmingly. I think it was just overwhelming. But now I've traveled a lot in the last 10 years, and, you know, I'm getting kind of flippantly careless about the whole thing, and I keep reminding myself though how grateful I should be that I'm just getting a chance to get out here. I never even planned on being a filmmaker; it just sort of happened. If I was left to decide what to do with my life, I would still be lying on the floor with my dog, rotting dog, you know, seeing no reason to remove its body. I've never been a very proactive person. I kind of backed into filmmaking. The shots in my first few movies were sort of receding shots. You know, I was pulling away from the subject matter, looking for a place to lie down. I had to be the world's laziest filmmaker. And, you know, the films are a little bit, luxuriously paced. At first, but now I've learned to be quite aggressive, and I'm pleased with the pacing of my pictures now. They're very exciting to me.
Well, Guy Madden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Terry.
Guy Madden directed and co-wrote the new movie, The Saddest Music in the World. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz on choreographer George Balanchine and the music he used for his dances. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Balanchine's birth. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of George Balanchine, the choreographer who many people regard as one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, is one of those people. This is an occasion for Lloyd to review some of the Balanchine material now available on DVD and even CD.
How many choreographers have their names on an album of music? Yet a Balanchine album, on Nonesuch, has just been freshly repackaged after being in print for 18 years. No choreographer ever had a more intimate connection with music than George Balanchine, which may explain why so many music critics like to write about him. I grew up in New York, and my first experience with dance as an art form was with Balanchine and the New York City Ballet. It was as if Shakespeare were living in Manhattan, creating new masterworks season after season. I was even lucky enough to watch him rehearse at the City Ballet's summer home in Saratoga Springs, New York. When he died in 1983, he left an astonishing repertoire, as dazzling, as profound, as varied, and easily as entertaining as any art in any medium created in the 20th century. Balanchine saw possibilities not only in the usual dance composers like Tchaikovsky, but in great masters like Bach and Mozart, difficult modernists like Schoenberg and Webern, even Sousa marches and Gershwin tunes. In 1928, he began a remarkable half-century of collaborations with Igor Stravinsky. Here's Robert Irving conducting Stravinsky's Aegon with the New York City Ballet Orchestra. Balanchine's dances are beautiful, but they are seldom merely pretty. Without words, they tell tragic and often witty truths about human interaction. In his overwhelming Four Temperaments, a score he personally commissioned from Paul Hindemith, Balanchine seems to discover the inner workings of the universe. Whether his ballets tell a story or are merely movements to music, with no scenery and dancers in black leotards, there's always the story of how movement embodies and reveals the emotional life of the music. Balanchine worked with some of ballet's greatest dancers. He even married several of them. Maybe the dancer who most inspired him was Suzanne Farrell, though she married someone else. Among the Balanchine discs now on DVD is Elusive Muse, the moving documentary about their relationship. It has a thrilling sequence filmed at the opening night of Don Quixote, one of Balanchine's most ambitious and personal ballets. Farrell is a phenomenal Dulcinea, opposite Balanchine himself in the title role. In May, Nonesuch is releasing on two DVDs 11 of the Balanchine ballets shown on PBS's Great Performances, including pieces with Suzanne Farrell and Mikhail Baryshnikov. And Kultur has just put out the magnificent 2-hour American Masters documentary called Balanchine. It covers his entire career, Russia, Paris, Broadway, Hollywood, and the creation of the New York City Ballet. And there are memorable interviews with Mr. B himself.
What is abstract? They mean storyless. But they have to, could be a meaning in it. You see, the people that meet, that one person gives a hand and the girl embraces, it's already has a meaning in it, you see? A duet is a love story almost. So how much story you want?
I especially love the clip from a 1967 performance of Apollo, the first Stravinsky music Balanchine ever choreographed. Dancing the Young God and the Muse of Dance are the young Peter Martins, who now runs the New York City Ballet, and the young Suzanne Farrell, who now has a company of her own. They're like young gods, not just brilliant, but unearthly. They dance with a kind of unself-conscious, spiritual passion, which may be the most central quality of Balanchine's genius.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post talks about his reporting from Iraq, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. Shadid started covering Iraq before the war and returned home last week. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.